Now, Friday interview, well known for playing confident and loudmouth, Mimi Maguire in the Channel 4 drama Shameless. Tina Malone is anything but loud and confident in real life. She grew up in a happy Catholic home, but things changed when she fell pregnant.
I was pregnant at 17 and gave birth to Danielle at 18, yeah. Unfortunately, that was another... out of everything inherently evil comes some good, and the boy or the man, I wouldn't call him a man anyway, the boy I fell in love with for a few weeks, few months, whatever, you know how it is then. Months feel like years. Messed me up big time and dumped me. And, of course, I was left pregnant and bewildered and a child with a child, really.
And you were nearly forced to give your daughter up. Why?
Yeah, because, you know, well, it's quite common, obviously, you know, amongst the Catholic countries, particularly in Ireland, I would say. I met a lot of girls who'd come over to these homes, mother and baby homes, which were predominantly in the 50s and 60s, but it was the 80s, so it was quite shocking. My father thought it was the best thing to have the baby taken off me. You know, here I was, 17, pregnant to a criminal. A man who was no good, who didn't want to know, and my father was devastated. I was the apple of his eye. And rightly so, he was devastated. But, you know, out of every huge mistake, you find some good. And the best thing I ever did in my entire life was keep my daughter, Danielle. And I was sent away to a mother and baby home. My family were told I'd gone away on a typing course, as was done in those days. Well, not in the 80s.
You were sent away to a home because you were pregnant?
Yeah, I was, yeah. And you know what? Stephen, I forgive my father, and I forgave him a year later. And what actually happened was I was sent away about 4 months pregnant to a Catholic home, and I was kept locked away for 4 or 5 months. When I gave birth, I was on my own. There were no flowers, no cards. And this is all well documented in the book,
and
which has been hard for my mother to read, you know, since, because obviously she's still alive and my father isn't, and she made the decision with my dad.
My goodness, you painted there a very solitary picture. You give birth and there's no celebration. In fact,
no.
There are no people. There's you.
No. And I was treated with quite a lot of disdain in the hospital where I gave birth, Warrington General Hospital. They were very, you know, they knew I was an unmarried mother giving a baby away. But this was 1981, not 1951. So, you know, it shouldn't have been such a shock, but hey-ho, it was. I had no painkillers. I gave birth on my own. And I had my baby with me for 5 days. My mother came in the day after I had her to see me briefly. And then my parents came on the fifth day and I was made to dress her, feed her, wrap her up and hand her over to social services. By which, the story goes in my book, she went into care and into
at that point, she wasn't well. At that point, Tina, where you are handing your child over, because that's not a little thing, even the physical act of you're giving your child away and you're being forced to do it, what was in your head?
It was horrendous, absolutely horrific, and still very painful when I talk about it, you know, today. But and within the 6 weeks before you sign, I don't know how, because I'd gone along with my parents' wishes, I plucked up the courage to say to my mum, I want to keep my baby. And she said, speak to your father. And I spoke to my dad and he said, if you keep that baby, you're going to ruin your life and you're going to ruin a couple of parents who've been found for this baby and beautiful, healthy child. And you'll ruin her life and your life and you know, you can't stay here. So I left and went and lived in my mother's younger sister's in Southport, miles away. And I went to social services and got my baby back.
So your father, who you said you forgive him a year later, he wouldn't even let you stay in his house anymore.
No.
If you had kept your own baby.
No.
Like, that sounds bizarre, extraordinary, wrong.
I'm minded
to say, what type of man was he to say that?
You know, he was a very loving father, a very doting father. He loved me and my brother Simon. But, you know, he was just very strict and he just believed it was the right thing to do. And ironically enough, when he met Danielle at 10 months later, when my mum kept calling to see me every week, he never did. And then he met Danielle, she took her out to him and he literally just drove up to the door and said, "Get your stuff, you're coming home." And I went home with Danielle and she became the absolute apple of his eye. And till the day he died when she was 21, 10 days after her 21st birthday, 11 years ago when he died, she was absolutely devastated. He was the most incredible role model she had and figure in her life. And he paid for her school fees, for her private education. He did everything to make amends. He knew what he'd done was wrong, but I was prepared to move on, forget. And, you know, it's part of what, you know, what's in the cats and the kittens and what's in me, I get from him. So my strength and my tenacity to go against their wishes and to go and keep my child was eventually the best thing.
Now, when we say that your life, Tina, has been a roller coaster, of course, for that to happen, that event in life to happen, that's massive. But it was only one of the bumps along the way, wasn't it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you read my book, there's nothing I haven't really done. You know, I've had women's issues, major women's issues. I've been through
those
things. Well, you know, I found myself pregnant a couple of times whilst at college, whilst trying to, you know, strike a career up as an actress, and then, you know, kind of had to terminate my pregnancies. I also had a couple of miscarriages.
How do you feel about abortion?
You know what? It was the right thing at the right time for me. And if anybody says to me now, you know, having the IVF quite recently, which is well documented, when and if I couldn't get pregnant in the last couple of years to my husband, Paul, did I ever go through those notions of, oh, my God, is this God paying me back for all those years ago? Did I feel any guilt or regret? No, I didn't. You know, sometimes you make decisions, you know, along the way, that are the right decisions. And, you know, as mixed up and messed up and stupid and irresponsible as I have been during my life, I've also made some quite rational, quite intelligent decisions, particularly where my daughter Danielle was concerned. She was only a young child, and it wouldn't have been right to have brought any more children at that time in an unstable relationship.
And you don't think back now, because of course in later life you were trying desperately for a child, and we'll talk about IVF in a second or two. But you don't look back now and think what might have been if you had kept those children.
No, because, you know, the time was right. And had I not got pregnant now, as we'll talk about in a minute, well, then, you know, I wouldn't spend the rest of my life thinking, you know, my God, had I had the two children I could have had, or the two I lost, would things have been different? Because then if you think you'd have gone a different path, I mightn't have been as successful as an actor, or as met the soulmate that I've met, the love of my life, or gone on to have given Danielle such a wonderful education and turned her into a well-educated young lady with, you know, a degree and a drama school. She went to a university, then drama school. She's a professional actress. She's engaged to be married next year. She's fully employed. She mightn't have become such a wonderfully liberal, well-rounded human being had I not devoted my time to her, whilst 50% of my time, I guess, was devoted to striking out a career.
And of course, a lot of your time along the way was devoted to things that you've managed to escape now. You were partying hard and you were drinking hard, weren't you? And in 1996, you were rushed to hospital. You were rehearsing for a pantomime in Stoke-on-Trent and the doctor gave you 2 years to live.
Yeah, well,
how much had you been drinking?
Everything to excess, Steve, in my life. It always has been. Food, work, sex, drink, whatever. You know, my substance of choice was always drink over drugs or anything else. And unfortunately, you know, whether that's genetic, whether it, my parents weren't drinkers, strangely enough, but, you know, we've all experienced drinkers in our families or on the peripheral family. I drank to excess, and, you know, I turned into, after 5 years in Brookside and a certain amount of success as an actor, you know, I became, I guess, slightly defensive and angry because I was turning into a big, fat, ugly bird. And the other side of me became a drinker because I could afford to, and I could afford to drink brandy and champagne. And so that's what I did. And because I didn't drink Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and only drank Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, although, you know, it turned into 30 gin and tonics a night or a half a bottle of brandy, I thought I'm not an alcoholic because I'm not sitting on a bench with a beard and a can of special brew. How wrong was I?
You called yourself a big, fat, ugly bird. Do you mean that about yourself?
Yeah, that's what I became. Yeah, absolutely. I'm a realist, Steve. Always have been. I've struggled with my weight since I was 28. I was in and out of teens. I went between size 12 to 10 to 8. You know, a year after I had Danielle, I was painfully thin. And then in my mid-20s, I went back up to a 12, 14. I'd guess I'd always watched my weight, even as a teen. But I was never obese. But at 28, 29, I started to gain the weight. And I mean 2 stone a year. Until by the age, by mid-30s, 32, 33, 34, I guess I was kind of knocking up to 17, 18 stone. And for a 5'1" bird, and suddenly you're on TV, you're in a well-known soap, you're invited over to Ireland or Tenerife or whatever to do PAs, you've got money, you've got a little bit of fame, and it goes to your head slightly, you know, you suddenly got front row tickets for Take That and Cats and God knows what else, and it runs away with you. And, you know, I'd kind of forgotten, in a way, guess about my craft and realised, you know, we were moving into that world in the 90s of celebrity-dom, unfortunately.
Did you really consider yourself ugly?
God, yeah, of course. Listen, my mother is a beautiful-looking woman. She's 74 and looks like Catherine Deneuve. My daughter is absolutely stunning. I was hit with the ugly stick, I guess, in the queue. I was never beautiful.
Why do you say that about
girl.
Yourself?
Well, I'm just a realist. I wasn't. I've never been beautiful. I can make the best of myself now. I've lost a lot of weight. But, you know, at 5'1", you're never going to be elegant. And I can't wear heels because I'm crap at walking in them. I'm fat, and I was fat and humongously fat. And some people carry weight well, you know.
And you became a diabetic, didn't you?
Yeah, I got diabetes type 2. I was injecting insulin for 22 years. I became diabetic.
Is it true you were on, when you were 45, you were on 32 tablets a day?
Yes, I was on metformin, almodipine, lisinopril, Actos, Avantos, all for like beta blockers and for heartburn, indigestion, high blood pressure.
All weight related.
All with the weight and the booze. Yeah. You see, the thing is, what I realised when I was diagnosed with bipolar at about 28 years of age.
I mean, God, diagnosed.
Well, that was at 28.
But let's talk about the diabetes first.
Okay. Well, what you can't control what you eat. And I hold my hands up, shoot me, I'm useless at willpower in certain aspects of my life. And I couldn't control what I was eating. And what happens when you inject insulin 3 times a day is it gives you a feeling of well-being. It controls your blood sugars. But what it enables you to do is eat more pies and cakes and biscuits. Well, actually, I've never been a pie eater. I'm a cake and a chocolate eater and biscuits, you know. So It gives you a feeling of well-being. It regulates your blood, so you think you're okay, and you pile on the pounds and you pile on the cakes. The diabetes isn't cured; it's just regulated and monitored
through having lost weight.
Well, no, not through losing weight. You're stabilising it, so they say. But when I wasn't. I was gaining.
When you lost the weight, were you able to come off the pills?
Oh, God, all I take now is a multivitamin and a garlic tablet
really?
Every morning. I lost 11 stone, 2 pounds, 2.5 years ago.
How?
Gastric band. I can't moderate, Steve. Never have been able to. So you can abstain from drugs. You can abstain from cigarettes. You can abstain from certain things. You can't abstain from what you put in your mouth. So I'm 15 years sober last month. That was the biggest hurdle. I'm getting over the booze. You know, with the help of various cognitive therapies and God knows what else, and therapy and stuff. And I had the gastric band unless you cut my head off, I wouldn't have stopped eating till I burst, Steve. It's just the way it is. I hold my hands up and I admit it. You know, I couldn't moderate. Whereas with the gastric band, it's been the best thing I've ever done in my entire life.
Did it work instantly for you?
Well, yeah, what happened was I looked at every clinic in the world because I was paranoid because I'd become that obese. I was 19 stone. It was 5 years ago. I was seriously depressed. I had money in the bank. I'd just done Big Brother. I was in Shameless. It was getting bigger and better, but I was getting bigger and worse. And I was sober. I wasn't touching drink or drugs, but I was eating like a pig. And whatever kind of psychologically takes you to a place where you do overeat or undereat, whether you're anorexic, bulimic or an overeater, who knows, you know? But basically, I was overeating and I was enormous. And now it wasn't just that I looked like a fat, ugly pig. I was killing myself. I was in danger of getting heart disease coupled with the diabetes, which inevitably brings on where you can become, lose your sight, lose your limbs with the diabetes. And I was fed up of injecting insulin. I went and had a gastric balloon. I paid for it like any other patient. They advised me not to have it because it's quite old, you know, it's almost prehistoric, the gastric balloon. You have that in for 6 months. They put it in down the throat, blow it up, and it's like an alien in your stomach. You have it in for 6 months. I lost 4 stone as soon as they take it out because before it wears away, they remove it. After 6 months, I put 2 stone back on again. They then talked me into having the gastric band, which they said the balloon had been a waste of time, really, but it had made me realise how huge I was. I then went and had the gastric band.
And what was it like to be thin for the first time?
Oh, my God. To walk into Harvey Nicks and buy a pair of Pinko pants and a Gucci dress, size 8, and put my thumb in the band. And I'm not talking elasticated. I'm talking zip and a button. Was just sheer joy. And I hate to coin the phrase, what was it Kate Moss said? And we all kind of vilified her for it. Nothing tastes as good as skinny feels.
Yeah.
Is so damn true.
We really should talk about you haven't been diagnosed as bipolar because no doubt until that diagnosis, Tina, you had wondered what was going on because you suffered from pretty bad depression, didn't you?
Yeah. Do you know what? I think I was a weird child. And if you read the book, it tells you all about what a bit of a weirdo I was. I was a lonely child at times, but I was a very happy child. I had a wonderful family. And I was diagnosed at 28 because I could have money in the bank. I was one of those people, 2 quid one day, 2,000 the next. And, you know, I'd give my last penny to someone. Me and Danielle grew up as like best friends. And I was diagnosed at 28 with bipolar, which was really, you know, you're talking 30 years ago. It was very unheard of. It was manic depression. And I knew that my mania was due to, which, you know what, helped my creative edge. I knew it was due to my madness. And, you know, if you look at people like Stephen Fry, I mean, he's somebody who's often said he wouldn't want to take away his madness.
Give me examples. Well, give me examples of your madness, things that you were doing.
I mean, apart from throwing things at people, you know, threw a tin of Pedigree chum at my friend John Hart's head because he upset me. Getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning, at 7 years of age, sitting in my bedroom, sharpening all my pencils so they face the same way. So my father took a bulb out of my bedroom till I was 14 years of age. Sitting, writing lists to do all my life, still do it now with a 12-week-old baby. Sitting at 3 a.m. doing ironing, putting the Sopranos on and cooking a lemon drizzle cake. I do that now. I'll cook 60 lasagnas to take in to the crew when I've got 6 scenes to do.
What was the low point for you?
When it gets mad, where you think everybody's out to get you, or you think you're useless and you get seriously depressed and you think your mum and dad hate you and everybody hates you and your daughter hates you. I had quite a lot of those baddies, serious bad panic attacks in my 30s, which was as well, you know, the alcohol is a depressant, which made things 10 times worse. So being off the booze has stopped those panic attacks, I firmly believe. But the bipolar, you know, I manage it now. But it makes me, my idiosyncrasies I've always been aware of, and people who live with me or are close to me know my madness. But I'm not somebody who contrives to be mad, Steve. I just am a little bit mad. Because since I was a kid, I don't care what people think of me. I never have done. I never will do. Unless you sleep with me and you pay my mortgage, I don't really care what you think, whether you like me or not. Because we can't like everyone, can we?
But the thing, just finally, Tina, is you should like yourself. And I've just...
I do now.
Yeah, but I didn't like when you described yourself as a big, fat, ugly pig. It doesn't matter what weight you are. Don't think about yourself.
No, but
like
that's how I felt. That's how
But you don't anymore.
I've been with my husband 5 years, who's sitting next to me patiently. He's heard all these interviews before. And I have a 13-week-old daughter tomorrow, beautiful Flame. I had the best man I could want in my life. He was 10 years in the army. He's been to Northern Ireland, Iraq, Afghan. He's seen things I never want to see. He's 19 years younger than me. His life experience brought to, you know, I'm an academic, I'm an intellectual, I'm a snob to a degree. I'm creative, I'm feisty. He's laid back, he's easygoing, he's very mature. He's been the best thing to happen to me. And because I've lost the weight, because I have this beautiful child, I'm the happiest woman in the world. And he makes me feel young.
How old were you when you met him?
I was 45, and he met me in a beanie hat in a fat camp, looking like a piece of, well, I won't swear, like a mess.
When you were 49,
yeah,
you decided to have a baby with Paul, and you opted for IVF treatment. Now, you were 14 years over the age, the cutoff age, to have IVF treatment on the NHS. You decided to go private. And with that came a lot of flack. What's a woman of your age doing trying to have a baby?
You know what, Steve? I could talk to you about this for hours. Basically, you know, it's a national, it's a lottery, a postcode lottery in this country, whether it's 36, 39 or 42, depending on the demographic of where you live, where the pot of money from the NHS goes, depends on whether you get IVF on the NHS. And if, in my opinion, if you're a woman who's been educated, you and your husband have saved up to get a home, to do things the right way, get married, etc., or your life partner, whatever sexuality you are, you decide to go for IVF, you should get IVF if you are 42 or years of age or under on the NHS, whatever your circumstances, out of a system that you have paid into. It's an absolute national disgrace that women are turned down. Now, I'm 50 and that's a different story. I'm not saying everyone should run out and get pregnant at 50, and I am not advocating that. I am not saying it was right for anybody to pay for it. We should pay for it. But you know what? It was my decision. We didn't do this on a whim. I took 2 years to lose weight, get physically, mentally, emotionally, financially ready to have this baby. So I deserved her.
I've one last question.
Right, go on. Sorry, I've become the poster girl of IVF, you see. I'm the Betty Grable of IVF.
Your IVF attempts were successful. You had a baby daughter on the 15th of December. Where did you get the name Flame from?
Okay, we were both watching regional news and a little girl came on the TV with her granddad. She'd just been the youngest ever wing walker in the whole of Great Britain. Could have even been in the whole of Europe, I'm not sure. And she'd raised money for a little baby brother who had cerebral palsy. And her name came up under, we were watching the article and her name came up, Flame Brewer. And we both went, Flame. And that was it. And of course, Steve, we've got the Frances Josephine behind it, you know, so she's Flame Frances Josephine Malone. So it's a good, strong Irish Catholic name.
I could talk to you for hours. You could talk to me for hours, but we are out of time. More is in the book. Tina Malone, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for your time, Steve.